Welcome to Your Turn, Mike Clausey. Glad to have you with us. And if you're on the East Coast, and particularly in the Washington area, we're looking at some snow. They're talking about between 4 to 8 inches inside the Beltway. And believe me, if you live in Minot, North Dakota, or Minneapolis, that's a lot of snow for us. So going to be an exciting week ahead. My first guest is Jennifer Mattingly. She is Director of Government Affairs for Shaw, Bransford & Roth, and as a result, keeps a keen eye on Capitol Hill. Jennifer, are you with us?
I am.
Hey,
hello.
Thank you for being here. Are you ready for the snow?
You know, I'm getting a little tired of it. Looking forward to some 80-degree weather sometime whenever that magically happens.
The good news to this, if you don't own a body shop or sell salt to the city or something, but it seems to me the good news is this has taken some of the heat, no pun intended, but some of the snow heat off of Washington, because normally every year people in real people who know how to handle snow and know how to drive on ice ridicule the metro area when we shut down schools and the government shuts down. But they've been so beat up themselves this year that maybe they're learning a lesson.
That's right. We've had quite a bit of cold weather. And, you know, as much as everybody here says 4 to 8, I still feel bad for the folks farther north than us. We're dealing with it a lot worse than we are.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a town in Maryland not too far from our studios here that gets more snow, I think, than Buffalo, New York, which is pretty scary.
Wow.
Okay, back to business here. You're watching the Hill. You're Director of Government Affairs for Shaw, Bransford & Roth. That's one of the best-known law firms in the city, particularly in the area of employment law. So what do you do for a law firm like that?
Well, what I do is the public policy side. So I represent, I have the privilege of representing a couple different federal employee associations. One that most people know me as is Legislative Director for the Senior Executives Association. So we certainly are right in the thick of things as legislation's moving forward on Capitol Hill and closely watching the activity up there.
Well, there's been a lot of talk, as there usually is at the beginning of the year. You know, the committees get new chairmen and people come in, and in the case of those assigned to the oversight committees of the federal government, everybody wants to reform something. And this year they're talking about, and sometimes reform can mean beat over the head with a big stick, too, but they're talking about reforming the senior executive system, you know, maybe starting all over again. They're talking about reforming it agency by agency, starting with places like the Department of Veterans Affairs. What are they talking about, and how serious is it?
You know, there's certainly, as you said, there's a lot of talk about reform, and really this started a year or two ago in the wake of all the, and I'm doing my air quotes here, scandals.
Yeah.
They all had high-profile names attached to them whom happened to be senior executives in the government. And so, for better or worse, focuses on the SES. Now, I think some of the talk is real, and in fact, what I've told some offices up on the Hill, and they're surprised about, hey, look, we welcome the talk of reform because Senior Executives Association has been calling for reform of the SES for years, and it just wasn't a hot topic at the time. The question is, how serious are people at looking for quick fixes, or how serious are they at doing real public policy and meaningful reform?
Well, and I guess you've got to look at motives, too, because there are people who genuinely want to reform things. Usually these are people that who agree with you, so you think they're genuine. But I assume there are also people out there who just maybe don't like the government, they don't like bureaucrats, they don't like high-paid federal workers, and they just like to beat them up.
Well, I think there's also a lot of misunderstanding. You know, it's not straightforward in a lot of, if you look at private sector, you've got your workers, your managers, your executives. In the government, you've got so many different pay systems. You've got so many different types of employees. And even at the SES level, people don't always understand who these employees are, what they're doing. So some of what we find is just a general lack of understanding of what it is that they're trying to do and who they're actually affecting. Because sometimes people get angry about something on the Hill, and they're really angry about something that has nothing to do with senior executives or has nothing to do with federal employees. And, you know, it's more a broader process that they're actually angry about.
Well, you have a situation where you can go back to the GSA, you know, the romp in the desert, that, as you say, the air quotes, the scandal. And then that was then you had the Secret Service, various problems up to and including keeping the White House fence safe and sacred. You have the Department of Veterans Affairs and the delays, the people getting bonuses for apparently doing good work when in fact they were keeping two sets of books. And then you have the IRS situation, the tax exemptions or not for certain groups. This was run out of Cincinnati, but some people think it was a agency-wide plot or it was run out of the White House. Now you've got Benghazi in Libya and a former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the New York Times and Washington Post revelations that she used her own private email for to conduct government business. And I guess all of this, it's like snow on a roof. It really weighs down the federal establishment, doesn't it?
Well, and when you talk about it, and the easy answer is, oh my gosh, it makes it look like governments run amok or these senior executives are run amok. And I always say a lot of these problems are far more complicated than just one or two people. I mean, the vast majority of federal employees are doing great work every day with limited resources. And so a lot of these problems have been around for years. Almost every IG report that's come out on, you know, GSA, Secret Service, IRS, they all have one thing in common that nobody ever talks about, and it's training. You know, the fact that budgets were cut, employees weren't being trained to do both their technical job, but also to be supervisors or to, you know, do performance management, things, basic building blocks of running an associate or running an agency. And so I think it's those issues that we've been trying to bring up to the Hill and say, wait, there's some real fundamental things. If you want reform, you got to go back to the basics. You got to train your people. You got to give them the resources to do their job, and then you got to let them do it.
You know, I've always thought, and I've said it in different ways at different times, but there's too bad somebody good, like a la Ken Burns, can't make a documentary about the government. And, you know, you can do the usual, show the variety of jobs, the forest ranger and the astronaut and all that kind of thing, but focus on two events. And one would be the FDR, the Federal Dispute Resolution, that you guys, I know, have a hand in.
Mm-hmm.
To various cities around the country. It's usually very nice places in summer, so they get a good rate. But hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of government workers go there, sent there by their agencies. And I've been to many of them, maybe even most. And the thing that strikes me about it is how each of the classes are full of people.
Yep.
They're there. These are in beautiful locales, you know, Palm Desert and whatnot. There's a swimming pool out there, and their spouse and kids may be out playing. But these people are in the conferences. I've seen it firsthand. They're taking notes. They're getting certificates and whatnot. And then segue over to the banquet, the annual State Department banquet, which I think was canceled last year for lack of funds or something. But the annual Senior Executive Association banquet at the State Department, when you go to that, in addition to just being completely impressive in every single way, you're seated at a table with the award winners and their significant others or spouses. And when you look at the accomplishments of these people, this is not some paper accounting thing. This is things that they've actually done. It is mind-blowing to see what people in government are doing every day.
Well, and it really is. I mean, some of these folks that have won distinguished rank awards, and SEA had the banquet, but they canceled the distinguished rank awards, which I thought was a real shame, because I think there's this fear, this idea that bonuses are going to all these people that don't deserve them, when in fact, when you look at the accomplishments of people, some of these are Nobel Prize winners. Some of them have done some amazing things, and they've saved the government billions of dollars collectively in the work they've done. And so it's those stories, too, that we're out there trying to say, wait a minute, you've got to understand why people are getting performance awards, why they're getting distinguished rank awards, because they are really doing some great things.
I want to ask you about the bonuses and things, but Lauren Larson, our producer, is giving us a signal here to take a break. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
What factors contribute to Austria's low rates of unemployment? How does Austria's dual educational system factor into it? What is the Austrian Public Employment Service doing to enhance the way it does business? And what can we learn from innovations being pursued there? Join Michael Keegan for the Global Conversations with Leaders series as he explores these questions and more with Dr. Johannes Kopp, Managing Director, Austrian Public Employment Service, next week on the Business of Government Hour. Tune in Mondays at 11 a.m. for the Business of Government Hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
You've been doing a great job, so we'd like to give you a promotion.
Thank you, sir.
Your suggestion of getting a graduate degree at the University of Technology Skills Relevant to the Real World really helped me.
In fact, that's how I got this position. I also got my master's at the University of Real-Time Online Classes.
Really? The University of Perfect Learning Format for Working Professionals?
Yep, the very same university I've endorsed by IEEE as a provider of quality engineering education.
The University of 100% Online Classes so you can learn from anywhere.
The University of Professors who are industry experts.
The University of Taking Over Your Boss's Job. I mean the University of Professors who are industry experts.
Today, Capital College is Capital Technology University. We've improved our capabilities to prepare you with the specialized graduate degree you need for succeeding in today's technology and information science field. Sign up for a virtual info session at theuniversityof.net and learn more about Capital Technology University, the University of Taking Over Your Boss's Job when it's available.
Hi, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show. Tune in next Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 and 820 a.m. to hear the latest from the food and wine scene. We've got celebrity chefs, sommeliers, winemakers, and more all here to tell you about the inside skinny that you won't find anywhere else. That's Foodie and the Beast this Sunday at 11.
On the next episode of Disaster Resilience for America, Bob Crouch, former U.S. attorney and assistant to the governor of Virginia for Commonwealth Preparedness, will discuss efforts being made to make collaboration easier for the public and private sector communities in homeland security and emergency management. Also, co-host Tom Moran will discuss a new app that details information on the availability of critical private sector resources, such as food, fuel, and lodging, during major power outages. That's next Tuesday at 2 p.m. on 1500 a.m.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I thought that music was going to go on forever, and it turns out I'm the one that's doing the wrong thing. Talking with Jennifer Mattingly here. She's Director of Government Affairs for Shaw Bransford, and she's been talking about the things that are going on the Hill, and we left before the break with the idea of bonuses and things for federal executives and the fact that many in Congress want to go after them. What's the deal on that?
Well, it's certainly been front and center for Congress over the past year, and really this last week, as the House at least engaged on a bill to allow the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to recoup bonuses from employees. And one of the things I do want to make clear on this bill, it's not just senior executives that this bill allows it to be done for. It's for all employees at the VA. For whatever reason, the Secretary decides that the bonus should be taken back. And so part of the problem that's for me about any of this is that, again, and it's sort of, we touched on it before, there's no conversation of what these bonuses are for, why they're given, who's getting them, and what it is that the people earn the bonuses for. Because by and large, especially at the SES level, it's for very strict performance requirements, or it's for some really outstanding work, as in the Distinguished Rank Award. So there's a legitimate reason why they're getting the bonuses. Now, could there be reform? I'm sure there's some reforms out there that we could look at. But that conversation hasn't happened.
Well, what's the dollar range in the bonuses we're talking about here?
Well, you know, by and large, and most of these bonuses are going to be, I think the average across government was about $8,000, $9,000 for a bonus if a senior executive got them. Now, for other employees and different types, they're going to be different levels. But at the SES, for their performance awards, the government and agencies have already capped these awards. They're already pushing them down, and they're really only given to those folks that receive an outstanding rating.
Do you know if they've actually done it yet in any case? If they've actually recalled a bonus and said, pay us back?
They haven't, because this authority is not, no agency has the authority to recall a bonus. So this would be a brand new authority for an agency.
That could be a nightmare for anybody if you got an $8,000 or $9,000 bonus, presumably paid taxes on it, spent it like in the American way, and then somebody said, we need it back.
Well, and the problem for us, too, is not only that, there's no time limit on this, so presumably they could go back and call for multi-year bonuses, and there's no real reason in the bill. The secretary just has to decide that the employee should give the bonus back.
Okay, and this would be, for now, at the Department of Veterans Affairs only?
Mm-hmm, correct. Okay. But I think there is some, more than some, there is interest in Congress at looking at expanding such authority.
VA today, tomorrow the world kind of thing.
Right. And Chairman Miller, who's the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, has stated in some media reports that he sees these bills that he's been pushing out that are VA-specific, because that's his jurisdiction, he sees them as pilot programs for the rest of the government.
Okay. Now, the reason, ostensibly, one of the reasons for the last big civil service reform, and that was the Jimmy Carter era. I think that was
78.
Some would say, yeah, that was one of the few accomplishments of the of the Carter administration. But they eliminated what were called super grades. I think it's GS 16, 17, and 18 grades. Put them into the senior executive service. They told the people, the incumbents at the time, they said, you don't have to join the SES, but if you don't, you're dead. You're not going anywhere. You will not be promoted. And everybody got behind it as a good government move. And the idea was that it was supposed to give the administration in power more control over the top levels of the civil service, and also, you know, more money for people for higher responsibility. And one of the things was a cross-agency and interagency training, and that is somebody might be an official at the Defense Department and then move over to Treasury or Justice, but people would, in theory, get experience in a variety of agencies, understand what other government operations do, why they do it, and it would, you know, we would all be happy and that sort of thing. Apparently, it hasn't happened. I guess the exception would be with the law enforcement agencies at places like the FBI and DEA, where they rotate people for a variety of reasons, including they don't want you to become too comfortable in your hometown turf. And the other is the Internal Revenue Service for pretty much the same reason. What's the deal on mobility?
You know, it's interesting because people have talked a lot about mobility and this idea that senior executives aren't moving. And now I have no hard data other than my own, you know, talking to folks on this. But almost every senior executive I talk to, with few exceptions, has moved a lot during their career. Now, they may not have moved as much once they were in the SES, but they certainly moved around agencies in the run-up to becoming a senior executive. And so I almost question why we're sitting here saying every senior executive needs to move and be mobile. I get that that's some of the idea, and I think in the series that your colleague Emily Kopp did over the past few weeks here on the SES, one senior executive was quoted as saying, why are we trying to implement a law that, you know, over the past 40 years either isn't working, hasn't worked? Why aren't we looking at what does the government need now? And I think that's a really interesting take on mobility, is do we really need to implement what was back then, or are people mobile? Should they be mobile before they get into the senior executive service? I don't think private sector companies would sit there and say, we need to rotate our executives just to rotate them. That's what I think we're going toward.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And some people would point to the military. You know, it's a double-edged sword. The military, you go somewhere for a specific period of time, 2 years and more. And if you look at the generals and admirals and you look at where they've been, you know, the husband or wife will say, we lived in 16 places in 14 years, or that kind of thing. And some people question the wisdom of that, because you move somebody, he or she changes everything. They know they're going to be there for a finite period of time, and they get into the ticket punching business, and you start moving around and maybe not doing the best job you could simply because you're preoccupied with your career.
Well, and I think we see that a little bit in agencies at the political level. You got folks in there for 18 months, couple years. They come in with an agenda, they leave, and then somebody else comes in, changes everything around. And I know that's a source of challenge for a lot of senior executives dealing with this constant rotation of political appointees. So one of my questions is, we haven't had that conversation about why we're rotating or if it's appropriate for every position, because it may not be. Maybe some people are great at rotating, some aren't. I grew up in a DEA family, so we moved every 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And it's tough on employees, it's tough on their families, and it's tough on the jobs and the people they work with.
Okay. Now, money talks. The president has proposed, I think it's a 1.3% pay raise, which is 0.3% more than he proposed in the previous years. Mm-hmm. You've got 31 members of the House and Senate, I believe they're all Democrats, who have proposed a 3.8% raise. What do you think is going to happen?
You know, that's a tough one because it depends a little bit on sequestration, on what they decide to do, what the Congress decides to do with budgets as we start those budget talks in the coming months here. I suspect, you know, if I was a betting person, I suspect that we'd see somewhere closer to what the president has proposed.
The lower amount as opposed to the higher
mm-hmm.
amount. Okay.
Just given that we're going back, you know, we had a 2-year budget deal, and at the end of this fiscal year, sequestration kicks back in.
Yeah, okay. What's pending up there on the retirement front? I know the, although they haven't done anything to incumbent members of the civil service, 2 years ago, they increased the amount people kick into the retirement fund for new hires, and then they did it again, I believe, last year. So you have now three tiers of people in the federal employees retirement system.
Yep, and you know they have all looked prospectively, and although I don't think any of the federal employee groups supported even these prospective changes, at least going prospectively as employees come in, they know what the deal is. You're not changing the game on somebody halfway through. But one of the biggest concerns on the retirement front is going back to this budget talk. If Congress can't pass a budget, can't pass the appropriations, and they decide, you know, haven't come to a deal on what they're going to do for sequestration, one of the ways they could approach this is to do something called budget reconciliation, where basically they decide on a number that each committee has to find in their jurisdiction of savings. You know, you have to come up with X million of dollars saved. Well, the Committee of Jurisdiction over Federal Employees, Oversight and Government Reform, the only spending pots that they can go to find those savings are in FERS and CSRS, so the retirements, or health care.
You know, I'm always leery of those estimates, particularly when they're 10 years out, and I'll tell you why. I was covering the Treasury Department one time, and this was during one of the oil crises, and they had a background briefing for a bunch of reporters, including myself, and one of the top officials there, he may have been the assistant secretary or something, but my recollection is at the time they were trying to make it look good, make the situation look good, so they said, we have a mobile reserve of X million gallons of gasoline. And it sounded pretty reassuring. And I knew nothing about the business, particularly about mobile reserves and oil and things like that. And I'm thinking of Teapot Dome, you know, literally an underground facility where they store oil and gas. And so I didn't want to embarrass myself. And after the thing, I went up to the guy and I said, what is a mobile reserve? And he looked funny, odd. And he said, it's the gas in your tank right now. And they had apparently estimated how many automobiles there were in the United States, and then they found out what the average car holds in its gas tank capacity, and then they took half or three-quarters of that, and that was our mobile reserve. And I thought, this is about as phony a figure as I've ever heard in my life, particularly if people report it, and it is reported as a good thing. So I'm always nervous when you have these reconciliation sort of things, and they come up with the savings, and you think, how real is this?
Well, and that's absolutely a good point. You just don't know because, you know, it's dependent on a lot of different factors. But be that as it may, whatever number they come up with would affect current federal employees.
I frequently heard people talk about Capitol Hill, and they said they can't do that, but au contraire, they can do that.
They can, and so far, yeah. You know, my hope is always, and the optimist in me says, you know, people do want to make policy and they want to make good policy. And the hope is that rational heads prevail on some of this stuff as we really get down to the finish line. But it just, you know, so often the events are being driven by what's going on and the pressure to get something done quickly. And
good
so
deal.
that's the question of, and so I know Senior Executives Association, most of the other federal employee groups have been up there talking to folks on the Hill already saying, you know, what is your plan if this is what happens?
Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us. We'll talk to you later on. Have a good week. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com.
And now it's time for another FedGuard Factor, career essentials for federal employees.
Attention federal managers, supervisors, and law enforcement officers. Are you missing out on a key benefit worth thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars? You are eligible to save up to 50% on the cost of professional liability insurance, and FedGuard can show you how. FedGuard can help you take advantage of this benefit and cover you against massive legal fees that may be required to defend you against charges that anyone can levy against you.
Learn more at FedGuard.com. That's FedGuard.com.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Visit myvillagegreen.com, listen to past shows, and discover other healthy living resources.
Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Zymogen and Metagenics.
For too many parents, a baby's first steps aren't just a milestone. They're a miracle, made possible by volunteers like you who walk in March for Babies. The money you raise funds research and local programs that help babies overcome the challenges of premature birth and birth defects. Sign up today at marchforbabies.org to take the steps that help make milestones and even miracles possible for thousands of families. Who will you march for?
Ball Aerospace has reimagined our universe with leading-edge space-based systems for nearly six decades. They've built seven instruments for the Hubble Space Telescope, capturing unmatched images that answer scientific questions, and enriched more than 40 years of global land observations by building the nation's newest operational land imager. Earth, Mars, Pluto, and beyond. Ball Aerospace. Agility to innovate, strength to deliver. Visit them at ballaerospace.com. That's ballaerospace.com.
Please join Jim Fleisig Tuesday, March 17th at 12 noon for his monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum, proudly celebrating their 10th season. This month's program will focus on virtualization and data center consolidation, progress and best practices. The panel includes government leaders from the Department of State, the FBI, and the U.S. Air Force. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum, Tuesday, March 17th at 12 noon, here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and online at federalnewsradio.com. Sponsored by Red Hat, Checkpoint Software, and Brocade.
This hour of news is brought to you by Boeing, who with Bell Helicopter builds the transformational V-22 Osprey, the ideal solution to the Navy's carrier onboard delivery requirement. V-22, ready to deliver more for the Navy.
The Federal News Radio news team is committed to bringing you the highest quality federal news and information, and we're always trying to get better. Help us shape our news coverage to be most valuable to you. Take our survey and give us insight as to what types of stories federal employees and government contractors want to know about and how you need them delivered to best suit your lifestyle. The survey is quick and anonymous. Just go to federalnewsradio.com, find the survey link right above our top story.
Hey, Mike Causey, welcome back to your turn. And before we talk to our next guest, Andy Medici from the Federal Times, I wanted to give you a possibly breaking bulletin. We're trying to confirm now that Colleen Kelly, the longtime president of the National Treasury Employees Union, is going to retire this year after the August convention. We got a memo that she purportedly sent out to various chapter presidents, and we're trying to confirm it with national headquarters. But if true, she's been president for 16 years, been a major force in the federal union movement, and it would be a loss for the National Treasury Employees Union. But in her memo, she said she wants to spend some more time in her beloved Pittsburgh and with her family. And so if true, we wish her well, and we'll bring you more on that. Now, go talk to Andy Medici, a senior writer with the Federal Times. Andy, you with us?
Hey, Mike, it's good to be here.
Hey, thanks for hanging on. Lots of stuff to talk about. You had a very lengthy piece this week about something that I know an awful lot of federal workers are looking at, and these are both old-timers or short-timers, people who are either ready to retire or eligible to retire, and young people who are anxious to see the graybeards go so that it will open up the promotion pipeline. And the issue is phased retirement. It's been I guess, the law of the land for almost 3 years now?
Yeah, 2012. We've been waiting years for the regulations. But before I get into that, I just want to say that I can confirm that Colleen Kelly is
excellent.
Stepping
okay.
down. So Thank for you. All the people who are interested out there, she'll be, you know, she'll be on her way out.
Get out your get out your retirement cards. Well deserved.
And but as for Faye's retirement, you know, which a lot of people are interested in, they passed the law in about 2012, and OPM really took a long time on these regulations. And the purpose for why they took so long was because they were working with agencies to make sure that they were implementable, that they were, you know, streamlined. And so in August of last year, they laid them out and they told agencies you can start implementing them November 6th. But all the agencies I've talked to, no one's done it yet. And OPM has said they haven't received a single phased retirement application.
And you spoke with Congressman Jerry Connolly, too.
I did. And, you know, he's one of those people that's been pushing for it for a long time. And then he also leaned on OPM real hard during that whole 2 year delay. And he's not exactly happy about it. He recognizes that there might be some delays for some agencies. But he said that if they don't start seeing something soon, he's going to be pressing agencies on why they're not implementing phased retirement plans.
Well, you know, this is one of those things where it's easy to say it's government. The government always drags its feet. But on the other hand, it would be the law of the land. It would impact thousands, maybe eventually hundreds of thousands of people. And obviously they want to get it right. They don't want to put some provision in there that's going to haunt them or make them subject to lawsuits. And as you, I think you and I were talking about this some months ago, and it's almost as if either a very big agency like the Defense Department, or which tends to lead the way in a lot of personnel changes, or a very small operation is going to have to, somebody's going to have to go first.
Right, and that's correct. But I think the fatal flaw in the law and the regulation that OPM developed was that they made it voluntary. It is not a mandatory program that agencies have to implement, which means that you could have the case where one agency does do phased retirement, offering it to their employees, and another agency doesn't. And for some federal employees, that would mean that they're left out in the cold, so to speak.
Well, you know, I was looking at the devil being in the details, and I was looking at a list of questions and answers that Tammy Flanagan, the benefits expert, did for us here at Federal News Radio. And we're going to have that the listing of that in tomorrow's column. But she was just listing questions from people, and some of the things that would seem to be obvious are not. For instance, people said, "I'm retired. Can I come back to the government and retire partially?" And while that may seem like a silly question, it's one of those things they have to answer.
And I think in this case, agencies have really dropped the ball. What we're hearing a lot from, you know, people who are asking you and people who are asking me is that agency HR offices aren't communicating with their employees on this matter. Agencies are being very mum about whether they'll even do it. But all that means is that you have a lot of federal employees who really don't know what's going on with phased retirement and what it means for them. And I think in that, agencies really did drop the ball on this one.
Okay. Switching over to defense, there have been cuts in the travel per diem.
That's correct. You know, last year, the Defense Department, trying to look for some savings, they took the long-term travel per diem and they cut it. So it dropped to about 75% for up to 180 days. And then longer than that, basically half. And the agency said that they would save about $22 million, but there's been a pretty strong backlash against those cuts in travel per diems.
Well, in the case of defense, in these current times, a lot of those people that are on per diem and for extended periods, meaning you're away from your family 30 to 180 days, they're in some pretty awful places like Afghanistan and like Iraq and like parts of Africa where the situation is whether it's Ebola or terrorists, it's tough duty, and to cut them back just doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, and the Defense Department, they said that it wouldn't hurt the living standards of the employees who were on that sort of long-term assignment. But a whole bunch of lawmakers got together last year, and they expressed their displeasure. And now they've introduced legislation that would roll those back because they said that it's not an acceptable cut. And you have federal employee groups who say that really what you're doing is you're shifting the burden of, like, living somewhere far away onto the employee itself, you know, who cannot maybe make ends meet with a 55% per diem.
Yeah, well, they're saying that from their plush apartments and homes in Arlington and Georgetown, they're saying it's not going to hurt the living conditions of somebody in Djibouti or Niger. That seems a bit cavalier.
Well, I think in this case, the Defense Department, they are looking for cuts wherever they can, but I think they miscalculated. They didn't really involve employee groups before they made the decision, and it seems like they really didn't run it by lawmakers either, because the people supporting this group, this might be one of the few bipartisan bills that you'll see in the House. It's been signed by Republicans and Democrats from all over the country, so you might actually see some real movement on this one.
If you can get Republicans and Democrats to agree on anything, you must be doing something either very right or very wrong.
That's exactly right, Mike.
You mentioned the magic word. Now, this time last year and before, we were sequestration came up every third sentence in our narrow little world of covering the federal government. Don't hear much about it now. You just mentioned it. What's the status of sequestration? Because I thought that there were going to be a series of automatic cuts each year for a 10-year period, and the first round, as you well know, produced the furloughs. The shutdown last year was for a different reason, but the furloughs were very real. 20% pay cut for hundreds of thousands of people. And yet this year we don't hear much about sequestration.
Well, it's getting more and more complicated, like all things related to Congress. But sequestration, when it was first implemented, there were cuts. But what sequestration actually is, the law behind it, is that it sets annual caps per year. And so the first few caps were excessively low, and caps in later years are different. They actually do increase a little bit. So Congress passed a law the other year that sort of lessen the impacts for the last 2 years. So that's why it's been a little bit better for agencies. In 2016, agencies are going to get hit with the next wave, and it's going to be damaging then. But right now, Congress is still sort of mired in what exactly are we going to do about it. So you don't really hear a lot because, frankly, there isn't really a firm or solid plan on how to deal with it. So it's something that we're going to have to worry about more next year and the year after that than the last 2 years.
Okay. Now, the situation at the Department of Homeland Security, I haven't looked at the wires in the last hour or so. What's the deal there?
Well, the House ended up passing a full-year funding bill, the so-called clean resolution, which means it doesn't prohibit President Obama's immigration executive actions. And the president expected to sign it sometime quite shortly. So for the time being, they have their funding through the end of the fiscal year.
So if you're looking at this strictly from a political public relations viewpoint, the Democrats win again, huh?
This was one of those situations where the Republicans, when they split the DHS bill off from the full year funding bill for the rest of government in December, they thought it would give them a chance to debate and to sway the public on President Obama's executive actions. That didn't happen. And as we saw, it just led to a series of sort of really brutal floor showdowns where the Republicans couldn't get the votes together. Democrats sort of let them hang themselves. But what you end up getting at the end of the day is what they would have gotten in December if they had been passed with the rest of government. So a lot of energy expended, and we still have a lot more legislation to go this year.
It's the Washington version of the California teenagers playing chicken, coming at each other with hot rods, on a narrow highway. But the last few actions like this, it seems to me that just in the court of public opinion, and certainly with most of the press, the Democrats have won it, rightly or wrongly.
And this is one of the situations where you had members of both parties saying things like, we want to keep the border secure, we want to make sure that, terrorism, anti-terrorism efforts are fully funded and underway. So it makes it really hard to then not fund the agency. And I think that's what ended up happening, is at the end of the day, no one wanted to take that chance, and the public didn't see why that chance had to be taken. So the argument about executive actions will have to play out separately.
It was interesting that ISIS made its warning about U.S. and European shopping centers right in the midst of all this. That could not have gone unnoticed.
Well, I think it's one of those reminders that, we live in a dangerous world, and there are groups out there, and so it really just highlighted in people's minds that having a fully funded agency that protects the borders is probably a good thing.
Okay, I'm going to take a short break here. I'm talking with Andy Medici from the Federal Times. Come back when I ask you about the pay raise, among other things. Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com.
Hi, Hi, this is Dr. Giannotto of the Giannotto Clinic, and Washingtonians have come to rely on me for age management and healthy living. And now you can listen to me live on my weekly radio show, Wellness DC, Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Please join me. I'll share cutting-edge strategies, and I'll share techniques for healthier lifestyle. So tune in on Saturday mornings, listen to Wellness DC with me, Dr. Giannotto, on 1500 a.m. and streaming live on federalnewsradio.com.
If your role within a federal agency is to improve program efficiencies using technology, attending the federal summit hosted by Infor is a must. Join Infor CEO Charles Phillips and federal VP Wayne Bobby as they welcome featured speakers, former White House CIO Teresa Payton and Gartner Managing VP Rishi Sood, to discuss actionable insights into achieving a safer, smarter, more efficient government. The Infor Federal Summit, Tuesday, March 24th, 7 a.m. to noon at the National Press Club. Limited space. Register today at infor.com/federalsummit.
The Microsoft Cloud for Government.
The Federal Risk Authorization Management Program is set to launch its new website, FedRAMP.gov, to explain the program's benefits to agencies and vendors. According to Federal News Radio, FedRAMP Director Matt Goodrich learned agencies and vendors were having trouble finding information on the current site and wanted to know more about the program itself. The new site will be easier to navigate and offer a better overview of the program's offerings. This is Jason Fornicola.
The Microsoft Cloud for Government is the perfect match for federal government services. With tools like Microsoft Office 365, Microsoft Azure, and Dynamics CRM Online, discover how the Microsoft Cloud for Government provides cost savings, rigorous security located in U.S. data centers, and hybrid capability with an integrated open platform, all from one trusted source. Become familiar with the Microsoft Cloud for Government, and you'll be prepared to move toward the future today. Visit Microsoft.com/cloud for government. Think big. Break the network status quo and start now at the 4th Annual Federal Forum 2015. Join government and IT innovators as they share how to begin the path to the new IP, an emerging network foundation for innovation. New this year, a technical track designed specifically for network, systems, and storage engineers. The 2015 Federal Forum, presented by FedScoop and Brocade, June 17th at the Renaissance Hotel downtown. Register now at federalforum2015.com.
Can you purchase anything today that costs less than $1? Even dime stores are now dollar stores, but SelectQuote may be able to help you get life insurance for less than $1 a day. How do we do it? By comparison shopping highly rated insurance companies, SelectQuote agents can help you buy peace of mind for under a dollar a day. That's how it worked for Alec, a healthy 38-year-old father of two who got a 10-year, half-million-dollar policy through SelectQuote for under $21 a month. I'm Nick Sobolewski, a SelectQuote agent. Visit us at SelectQuote.com or call now to discover yes, you can get life insurance that meets your needs at an affordable rate.
For your free quote, call 1-800-900-1665. That's 1-800-900-1665. 1-800-900-1665. Or go to SelectQuote.com. Since 1985, we shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
The Federal News Radio news team is committed to bringing you the highest quality federal news and information, and we're always trying to get better. Help us shape our news coverage to be most valuable to you. Take our survey and give us insight as to what types of stories federal employees and government contractors want to know about and how you need them delivered to best suit your lifestyle. The survey is quick and anonymous. Just go to federalnewsradio.com, find the survey link right above our top story.
What are the biggest federal stories of the day? Check out the Most Read section on federalnewsradio.com, your source for the latest news affecting federal employees and contractors.
Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. And just a reminder, as we're facing a mini blizzard in many parts of the country, including they're talking about 4 to 8 inches of snow inside the Beltway. And that's a lot for us. Say what you will, but that's a lot of snow for us. And if you are homebound tomorrow. We're still going to be on duty here at Federal News Radio. So turn us on, listen on your computer. Be sure and check the homepage because there will be breaking news, maybe a lot of it because of the weather. So stick with us through thick or thin. Talking with Andy Medici from the Federal Times, and Andy confirmed what we'd heard earlier, that Colleen Kelly, the longtime president of the National Treasury Employees Union, is going to retire this summer, I guess in August, after the NTEU convention. She said she's had a wonderful run. She's loved every minute of it, but she wants to get back to her Pittsburgh roots and her family there. And so we wish her a lot of luck. Andy, pay raise. When I first started on this beat, the Federal News was a big deal for the Washington Post, the old Washington Times, and there was even the tabloid Washington Daily News. They all had federal columnists. I worked for one of them for a long time. And one of my duties was to go to Capitol Hill 2 or 3 days a week to cover hearings 2 or 3 days a week on the issue of federal pay raise. The president would propose an amount, a member of Congress would propose another, another member of Congress would propose another, the unions would testify, but it was a year-long story. It would begin in January, reach fruition in November, December, and there'd be a pay raise. And I calculated at one point, if you were doing a daily column 5 days a week, that you might write as many as 60 to 80 exclusively what's it going to be pay raise stories. And it's a wonder it didn't get old, but it was actually news at the time. We do it differently now. Somebody comes out, the president possibly, and others come out and say, here's what feds ought to get next January. It kicks around, but it's not the big deal it used to be.
No, I don't think there's a lot of, let's call it, institutional energy in Congress to debate a pay raise vigorously, because more than likely, the last couple years at least, Congress hasn't passed any pay raise. So President Obama has been the one to set the pay raise. So in that situation, not hundreds of stories, a few, but at the end of the day, what ends up happening is you get President Obama's pay raise. That's what's happened the last few years at least.
Well, the interesting thing is back in the day, you had the Senate Post Office and Civil Service Committee and a House Post Office and Civil Service Committee, and their jurisdiction was the old Post Office Department and the Civil Service. And many of the members were very cozy with federal unions, and these were good times for federal employees because they went up, they got pretty much what they wanted in the way of pay and benefits. Since they changed the jurisdiction of these committees, now things like pay raises are just a minor item in their portfolio.
I think that's correct. You know, there are a lot of members of Congress maybe that would want to give employees more or want to give employees less, but no one really wants to spend that much political capital on it. You have legislation from Democrats in the House that would give federal employees a 3.8% pay raise in 2016, but that legislation was introduced last year and it doesn't look like it's going to pass. So what you end up happening is just members of Congress focus on other things, and that's still what's happening in this case. And President Obama has, you know, proposed a 1.3% pay raise, and unless Congress does something differently this year, that's probably what's going to be.
What else are you working on now?
Well, I think what we all need to look towards is, now that the DHS budget's finally complete, it's already March, which means that we should start looking at next year's budget. You know, we talked about federal employee pay raises, but you know, what's old is new again, and we're going to have the same funding fight for the government that we've had every year the last few years. And the appropriations process has just broken down completely. You might have, the House might pass legislation for each agency like they used to, but it's widely understood that that legislation doesn't really end up going anywhere. That House and Senate leaders meet and decide on a continuing resolution for the next year, you know, a 1% increase overall or whatever that might be.
You would think that given the what's happened in the past, that they would stop doing that and go back to business, their very basic business, but doesn't seem to be any sign that's going to happen.
Well, you know, we talked about, you know, there was the shutdown in 2013, but, you know, a lot of people who were up for re-election got re-elected. So, you know, whether there were any real electoral consequences to make people think twice, that's hard to gauge. And I think when, you know, each district has 700,000 people, maybe half are from your party, and maybe a quarter of them vote in your primary, there's really only one group you want to appeal to, whoever that might be. And we're going to have really tough funding fights. Will there be a shutdown? I can't answer that up until when there actually is one. but there are going to be really tough funding fights, and you know, federal employees will be in the mix of that for a while now.
Well, I think the last shutdown surprised a lot of people, and I know you and I were talking about it in Dr. Strangelove terms, and that is the White House creates this poison pill sequestration, knowing it will be a deterrent. The Republicans fall for it, buy into it. Everybody's sort of horrified. Everyone was predicting that there couldn't be a shutdown because it would be so incredibly stupid, and yet we had one.
I think what led to sequestration was that sort of budget commission that was supposed to recommend cuts.
Right.
And I think all we ended up doing was sort of creating a trap for ourselves, you know, creating a mechanism to punish Congress if they don't pass laws. All that leads to is other people getting punished, right? Members of Congress get paid, they show up, they do their, you know, they do yeah. whatever work they do. But federal employees, you know, taxpayers, agencies, the services that they do, those are the ones that ended up getting hit. And while people didn't think it was going to happen, you know, creating that deadline and that mechanism, hey, it happened. And, you know, we're now in the thick of it. And I think for a lot of people, that's still an ongoing debate, is what on earth are we going to do in the following years when
it
comes to budget.
That's right. It was intended to be like the BRAC, the Base Realignment and Closure Commission. It didn't work that way. I guess it was the Simpson-Bowles Commission. And ironically, the only recommendation that I can think of that actually came out of it and became law was the federal pay freeze. They proposed it, I believe, for 3 years. The White House bought a 2-year pay freeze, and then the Congress tacked on a third year for good measure.
Well, and if I remember correctly, and I guess it's a few years old now, so it's ancient history yeah. in Washington terms, but the Simpson-Bowles Commission, the commission couldn't even agree on their recommendations.
That's right.
It was just a couple of people. And so maybe the commission should have had a commission to decide which way the commission should go. You know, when you end up let's call it outsourcing your legislative responsibilities, and that's what Congress did, and we're kind of all paying the price for it now.
Yeah, that's the worst kind of Washington full employment solution, a commission to work on the commission, to work with the committee.
Right, and, you know, now, you know, we're talking about how to get out of sequestration, and, of course, technically, Congress could get together tomorrow and just say sequestration over, and they could pass that resolution, and then we go back to the way things were, but we're kind of stuck in it now because it's become sort of the norm, and you know, you had guests on talking earlier about federal employee pay and benefits. As long as you have that sort of budget pressure, you know, those will be at risk in some form or another.
Very good. Andy Medici, thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you next week. Everybody have a good week, and if you're in the Snow Belt area, be careful the next couple of days. We'll see you here next Wednesday at 10 a.m.